Madam Clerk, would you please call the case?
Case 1-220610, People v. Darius Duncan.
Counsel, we have allotted 20 minutes for each side with an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. So you don't need to reserve your time when you step up. Remember that the microphone that is in front of me and will be in front of you when you approach the podium is wonderful in terms of recording your voice for the audio and for posterity. However, it's not very good in amplifying your voice for those of us that are up here, so we ask that you speak. Be mindful of that and make sure that you keep your voice audible so that we can hear you as you are speaking also. With that, when you're ready, you can proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Talon Murray with the Office of the State Appellate Defender on behalf of Darius Duncan. This case is a long time coming. 23 years ago, Darius Duncan made his first of many attempts at securing his right to a direct appeal because his trial counsels were ineffective in failing to satisfy the most minimum of professional standards by simply filing a notice of appeal. That Mr. Duncan's trial counsels were ineffective in failing to secure his right to a direct appeal is not in dispute. The state has already conceded this point at the third stage evidentiary hearing, which took place nearly 20 years after Mr. Duncan's trial. During the entirety of that 20 years, Duncan resiliently and tirelessly pursued every possible avenue available to him to try and get where we are today. And where we are today is an unprecedented situation, and I mean that in the literal sense. This appeal presents a truly unique and singular set of circumstances. As I'll discuss, Darius was not only deprived of his right to a fair trial, he has now suffered from an inordinate delay, which has now deprived him of his right to a fair appeal. Arguing a direct appeal 23 years after trial proceedings concluded is itself unacceptable, and alone is sufficient to mandate that relief be granted. Arguing a direct appeal 23 years later without critical trial transcripts of the court's findings in a bench trial, and the loss of those transcripts which resulted from the inordinate delay, thus completely foreclosing meaningful appellate review, is likewise unacceptable and is tangibly prejudicial, and that requires that relief be granted.
Is there any case law to support your argument about that missing transcript from the court's ruling that means he is entitled to a new trial or an outright reversal?
Well, the case law differs depending on the nature of the lost transcripts.
Right.
And the question is whether, first the question is who's responsible for the lost transcripts. And we would argue that the state is responsible for furnishing the transcripts. And not only did Darius work tirelessly to obtain his transcripts, so did his post-conviction counsel who for 7 years. But then in addition to that, whether there's a sufficient substitute for the transcripts. And in this case, there's no sufficient substitute.
But there's only one transcript that's allegedly missing, right?
That is correct.
Okay. And it's from the ruling. Do we even know if the trial judge made a detailed ruling such that there would be reasoning or any analysis on the record?
We know at least that the judge stated in a sort of boilerplate post-trial motion that it did consider a lesser included offense. Counsels filed a boilerplate post-trial motion and referred to it as voluntary manslaughter rather than mitigated form of murder, second degree murder. But we don't know. No, so we don't. Other than that, we don't really know. But that isn't to say that the judge didn't, and we don't know whether the judge did or did not. But because we don't know, there's no way to determine. There's various errors that are presented to this court today. Trial errors that would require, many of which require, a showing of affirmative prejudice because it was a bench trial, improper consideration of insinuation that various witnesses were scared to testify. And we don't, there, as I will get to, there was very critical trial evidence regarding shell casings found at the scene. And these shell casings completely undermined the state's theory of defense, which was that Darius had a revolver that could not expel spent shell casings, and that he was the lone shooter. So the existence of these shell casings corroborated his defense of self-defense that he was shot at prior to shooting.
Now, the state indicates that there was some error in the making of the stipulation, and that's not, in fact, what the evidence showed.
At this point in the proceedings, the state is not at liberty to rewrite the record through argument. If it believed that the report of proceedings was inaccurate in some way, then it should have availed itself of Supreme Court Rule 329. Under circumstances like this where that procedure has not been properly followed, the record on appeal is to be taken as true and correct unless shown to be otherwise in a manner corrected you know, via that proper procedure.
It is very oddly worded, though, isn't it? He found bullets or shell casings?
It is. I would say perhaps, but maybe the oddly wording was the or could have been an and. And there was another portion of that stipulation was that there were bullet damage in a nearby house or like a front door.
Right, but no indication of when such damage occurred, right?
No, I mean, it was presumed that it was based on the shooting. So there was some sort of forensic evidence that was recovered at the scene of the shooting.
But do we know that it was connected to the shooting? The stipulation doesn't make that comparison.
Well, the stipulation was agreed to by both parties that it was connected to the shooting. And related to the stipulation, it is conclusive to all the matters that were included within it. And to contradict the context of the record, you must be able to point to some other context of the record, some memorandum, minutes, or other paper in the file. That is from People versus Ware. And this is the state's attempting to directly contradict what the parties agreed to and what is explicitly stated in the record on appeal here. So going back to this unprecedented situation with this loss of these critical trial transcripts, that alone requires reversal in this case. But what makes this case...
They're not missing any trial transcripts, right? All of the testimony and everything else, we have transcripts from all of that part of the trial, correct?
Correct.
So the only transcript that might be missing is one when the judge gave his ruling, and we don't know whether or not he even made a ruling such that there would be a transcript.
Well, they most definitely are missing. And he made some sort of statement on the record before he found Darius to be guilty. And there's a difference between a circuit court or trial court not being required to make any findings on the record and not being able to utilize those findings when they are made.
But
and again,
how do you know he made the findings? I think you said previously you don't know, but you presume he did. But we don't know that he did.
And in this case, based on the fact that we don't know, that's a factor that weighs in Darius's favor. Because again, he's been in custody on this case for 27 years. For 23 years, he was tirelessly trying to obtain these transcripts. If there wasn't some egregious breakdown in the system, he would have been able to either obtain the transcripts as they existed or obtain some sort of reasonable substitute. If there was a few years there after his trial where his attorneys hadn't been indefinitely suspended from the practice of law, Judge Porter was still practicing for 18 years post-trial. The court reporter, the affidavit we have on the record said the court reporter was retired in 2017, which is itself 14 years after the trial. So due to no fault of his own, he is entirely foreclosed from being able to affirmatively establish prejudice, which is what's required for a number of the claims before this court today. But as I was saying, that alone is sufficient for requiring that Darius be granted relief. But what truly makes this case one of one is that combined with the chaos that surrounded Duncan's attorneys, the same ones who I said have already been found ineffective in failing to file notice of appeal. And while that failure is the original sin that sort of started this 20-year delay, it was actually merely just a symptom of the professional and personal tribulations that were present throughout the representation of Mr. Duncan. The fact that they both have been subsequently suspended indefinitely That was actually a long time coming as well. But again, that sort of just corroborates their incompetence here.
How can we use the fact that they were subsequently suspended or disbarred by the AODC? If this is a direct appeal, we're limited to the record from the direct appeal, not to some documents attached to a post-conviction petition that are in this record or things that are not in the record about their disciplinary history.
There's a couple of answers to that. One, that is in the record on this appeal because of the unique nature. As I said, this is an unprecedented situation. And because of the unique nature of those, the AODC records are in the record on appeal. Additionally, this court can consider AODC records. That's happened in multiple cases, specifically People v. Williams and People v. Sanchez and People v. Franklin. The Illinois Supreme Court said criminal records such as circuit court documents, abstracts may also be considered. And then specifically in regard to Howard Tolles, his AODC records and his Will County criminal docket abstract and the associated records overlap almost exactly with his time. But he was suspended before he represented Darius, I think 2 weeks before he filed his first appearance. His first suspension had run. He was suspended before and immediately after. And in those 2 years, in addition to being himself arrested 3 times and held in contempt of court once and placed into custody, he was facing new AODC complaints, which are in the record before this court. And I just had to note that one of the founded complaints that resulted in his suspension immediately after Darius's case was lying to a client, saying that they lost an appeal when he actually never filed a timely notice of appeal. So not only are they in the record, and even if they weren't, this court could and should consider them. They directly relate to the exact time period that we're speaking with in terms of Darius's representation.
Clearly, the issue regarding the failure to file the notice with Tolles has some relevance because that is one of the issues in this case. But for the fact that there was a failure to file the notice, we might not be here 23 years later trying to put the pieces together. However, we have to look at the performance at the trial to determine whether or not there was whether or not the performance was so deficient that is a cause for reversal.
Absolutely. And to be clear, we are not making a claim that the AODC records or the Will County records or all this other stuff alone would require, maybe it would, but that's not what we're arguing, that it would require relief in this case. There are discrete errors that are specifically tied to Howard Tolles' insufficient representation. As I said, so the first day that he was supposed to appear, he didn't show up, and his co-counsel said he was supposed to be here. I called him. I didn't hear anything back. This continued throughout pretrial proceedings. There was miscommunication about who was supposed to be at court, when an answer to discovery was or wasn't filed, when a trial demand was made, whether an affirmative defense was disclosed. And then when we got closer to the actual trial date had been set, and Tolles would go missing for weeks at a time, and David Jordan, co-counsel, would come in and say, I don't know where he is. He wasn't here last time. I know it was set for trial. I called his office. I haven't heard anything back.
And then at least on one or two occasions, the defendant agreed to move forward with just Mr. Jordan, even though Mr. Towns wasn't there.
Darius was eager to go to trial. It was actually David Jordan who was uncomfortable proceeding to trial without Howard Tolles. He informed the court, Mr. Duncan has paid Mr. Tolles a lot of money. And then in that same day, David Jordan said, because Darius was eager to start trial, David Jordan was hesitant to do so. He said, but don't worry, we can stipulate to some stuff. This will sort of go along quickly. And one of the things he said was that we'll stipulate to the guy who took pictures and that kind of stuff. That's what he referred to as these shell casings, the guy who took pictures. And these shell casings, as I said, directly supported Darius' self-defense, yet counsels never mentioned them, never highlighted the import of them, nor how they corroborated Darius' defense in general, but also his testimony that Tavares and Willie Mullen were previously outside of his grandmother's house when Darius was on the porch and they were waving guns and threatening him. And then it corroborated that Darius as he passed them, he thought he was being shot at. It also corroborated Antonio Edwards' testimony regarding actually seeing Tavares Johnson with a gun immediately prior to the shooting. And that actually also relates to the two sort of discrete errors that I wanted to just highlight that are a good example of both counsel sort of just ongoing ineffectiveness and miscommunication and how that sort of just permeated every aspect of this case, denying Darius a fair trial. And the other thing that these two discrete errors highlight is that how Darius is sort of now prejudiced with the loss of these transcripts. So one is the stipulation to this critical evidence and the fact that that originated based on this sort of constant missing of trial dates and having to reschedule and Mr. Jordan, easing the court's mind and Darius's mind about, well, don't worry, we'll get this done quickly, so we'll just stipulate to all that. And then the second one was Antonio Edwards, in defense counsel's opening statement, they were very clear that he was the state's most important witness because he was with Darius, he was walking with Darius when the shooting occurred. And when he initially gave a statement to police, he said that Tavares Johnson had a gun. During cross-examination, or when he recanted that statement at trial, in cross-examination they were trying to go into depth on the recantation, when it happened, why. And the state objected, and there was a sidebar wherein the state said that they didn't want any discussion of where this happened because of a completely unrelated shooting that had nothing to do with Darius whatsoever. And the court said, okay, we're not going to get into where this happened, but obviously they can get into this conversation and, this recantation. And inexplicably, David Jordan said, well, Your Honor, it is 4:15, and Howard Tolles has to leave at 4:30. Mind you, this was a two-day murder trial. Howard Tolles was late to both days. Not only was he late to both days, he had to leave early the first day during this cross-examination of what both counsels said was the state's most important witness. After the sidebar was concluded, Howard Tolles came and said, no further questions.
But don't we need an offer of proof or an affidavit or some other sort of indication of what testimony he would have elicited had he done that cross-examination in order to be able to really assess this ineffective claim?
Again,
we don't have, and it's on direct appeal, and we don't have that information.
It's on direct appeal 23 years later, yes.
Right, but I don't think we can consider things that weren't involved in the direct appeal, so we don't have any other information about what he would have said.
We have an understanding, I will say this, we have an understanding that counsel's sort of ongoing issues, as I said, it's throughout the record. It's all over the record about not being able to communicate, one person showing up, nobody showing up. And this also coincides exact time frame-wise with Howard Tolles doing the exact same thing in his own criminal case, getting arrested multiple times in his own criminal case and held in contempt of court because of his disregard for the procedures in his own case. So at the very least, we know that there was many, many discrete errors. And we know that this coincides specifically with the personal and professional problems that Howard Tolles was going through. So at the very least, this court could, if it doesn't want to follow Williams, which I think it should, I think Williams is very closely related to this case, where the Illinois Supreme Court said that in very extreme situations, and very clearly the court did say, will rarely if ever be duplicated, this is one of those cases. It's not, of course it's not exact, but it is one of those rare situations where consideration of all of these things outside of court, when there's a sufficient record of it, has bearing specifically on counsel's representation in this case. And thus this court can forego a traditional Strickland analysis. If this court, for whatever reason, is uncomfortable with that, there is a number of errors that I think this court can focus on. And of course, without these transcripts, I want to be clear, it's Darius who's prejudiced by the loss of these transcripts. Of the many contributing factors of this 20-year delay in the loss of these transcripts, it should be clear that the one person who's not to blame is Mr. Duncan. And so some of these discrete errors, he is foreclosed from establishing traditional Strickland prejudice. However, this court could look holistically to all of the errors discussed in the briefs and find that, cumulatively at least, Mr. Duncan was deprived of his right to a fair trial. And regarding the cross-examination of Antonio Edwards and how that sort of highlights this ongoing problems that lead counsel had to leave early on a murder trial of the date he was late as well, it was at least brought into the record that Mr. Edwards did make an initial statement regarding seeing Tavares with a gun. But with the lost transcripts, we don't know how the court, what credibility determination it made with regards to Antonio Edwards and his recanted statement. And again, I'd just like to highlight that Howard Tolles' personal and professional issues, again, they overlapped almost completely, where his first appearance in this case was February of 2000, and Darius was sentenced January of 2003. And it overlapped so precisely that in between court dates, the date before or the after the close of evidence and the day before the court announced its findings, Howard Tolles was in Will County pleading guilty to this DUI case and the related driving on a suspended license cases that had been festering for 6 years, the very day before. And then at sentencing, this chaos sort of, it continued. They said that they were, quote, unprepared to present mitigation evidence after the state had presented, very strong victim impact statement. And earlier in filings, I think it was for a motion for reduction of bond, counsels noted that Darius had very supportive friends and family. They specifically asserted that he had over 10 members of his family who came to court every day as this case went along. And yet they were not prepared to present any mitigation evidence. They were misinformed regarding whether Darius was eligible for day-for-day credit. They didn't even file a motion to reconsider sentence. They filed a motion for a new trial that said if the court imposes a sentence above the minimum, that would be excessive, and yet never even filed a motion to reconsider sentence. So again, it should be very clear, counsels were out of their depth. I don't know if I would assume it was because of these personal and professional issues. And again, it sort of permeated the entirety of this case, and there's no way to separate any one claim. And in that case, and furthermore, as I said, this court should forego a traditional Strickland analysis based on the sort of egregious nature of all of the individual errors in this case. And I just very briefly...
Right, wrap it up.
Okay, sorry. Very briefly, I just want to say that at a minimum, Mr. Duncan should be granted a new sentencing hearing because the court improperly relied on a void prior adjudication in aggravation before imposing a sentence that was 30 years above the minimum. At a sentencing hearing, the state expressly asked that Darius's PSI be amended to include this juvenile adjudication for UUW. And that adjudication is void ab initio. And the state specifically highlighted this adjudication as a factor in aggravation. The circuit court likewise referenced Duncan's prior criminal background as a factor in aggravation. And other than this, what they refer to as gun charge, it was minimal. He had one conviction for possession of cannabis and one conviction for possession of a controlled substance. And under these circumstances, the record does not establish that the court's reliance on this void conviction was so minimal that it did not affect Duncan's sentence. As I began, Duncan has waited for far too long for a full and fair review of his convictions and sentence. And because that is no longer possible, we ask that Your Honors reverse his convictions and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Now we're going to ask everyone to please be seated. If you have any problems hearing, please come up further so that you can hear, but we need everyone to be in their seats. Please proceed.
May it please the court.
Yes.
My name is Sarah Simpson, and
I'm
going
to keep your voice up.
Assistant State's Attorney Sarah Simpson on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois. While this is a procedurally unusual case, the record in this direct appeal establishes that the defendant was properly convicted at trial, had a fair sentencing hearing, and was properly represented by counsel. I'd like to begin by responding to defendant's argument about the time that has taken for his direct appeal from the time of the sentencing hearing. And as stated in our briefs, the court has only dealt with this case on two occasions, People v. Sims and People v. Sistrink, that we both referred to in our briefs. And as Justice Clich pointed out, they have never reversed for a missing transcript, which we'll talk about in the second issue. But in Sims, and the court has agreed that to the factors in Barker v. Wingo, the United States Supreme Court factors, when determining if the length of the delay from sentencing hearing to notice of appeal would be considered a due process violation. And in Barker, they came to four factors that we look at, which was a speedy trial case based on the Sixth Amendment right to the speedy trial. And that's the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, the defendant's responsibility to assert his rights, and any prejudice to the defendant. So looking at those four factors, if you look at the length of the delay in this case, and there's a slight difference. In Sims, the court looked from the date of sentencing to the date the notice of appeal was filed. So in this case, that would be January of 2003, to the time of this late notice of appeal after the third stage evidentiary hearing in April of 2022, which is about 19 years. And in Sims, they found the 17-year delay, and there would be a threshold inquiry that would have them look to the further factors, so we should do so in this case as well. So looking to the next factors, which would be the reason for the delay, which we have to kind of talk about in commensurate with the defendant's responsibility to assert his rights. And there's several procedural happenings during that time that are important. The first is the time it took the defendant to file the post-conviction petition.
Now, are you assuming in this discussion that it is common knowledge that the lawyer will not file a notice of appeal after saying he would file a notice of appeal, so everyone should take that into consideration and go out and file their own?
No, no, not at all.
Probably in this case would be a good reason for them to do that.
Well, there is, it looks, and it is, as we talked about, he eventually did get that remedy. It appears that there might have been, there might have been some discussion about whether representation entailed at that point, but no, absolutely not. If he said he was going to file it, and that's what the defendant said, is his post-conviction petition, and taken that's true at the post-conviction proceedings, which is why the parties agreed, you know, essentially did a summary remand and then stipulated at the hearing that he should have this remedy, right? So no, absolutely, they shouldn't assume that. However, the defendant found out that his attorney hadn't filed that notice of appeal by June of 2003. So that's when he filed his first late notice of appeal in the circuit court that was denied. So we can certainly take the time from that June 2003, when he learned that his attorney had not done what he had thought that he was going to do, to the time of his post-conviction petition in 2006. So that was almost 3 years there. And so, as the court found in Sims, the defendant has to take some responsibility for that delay in the time.
And he did make time, he did try to get a direct appeal during that time. He filed multiple motions for late notice appeal, both in this court and a supervisory order in the Supreme Court, and all of those options were denied.
He certainly did. But the case law says that a defendant can pursue a direct appeal and a post-conviction petition at the same time. So, and while there's nothing wrong with him waiting for that time to put all of his issues in the post-conviction petition, because as we know, you get one post-conviction petition.
As we know. And we're going to just presume for the sake of this discussion that this defendant was not schooled in the law.
Right, but he did file an appropriate post-conviction petition within the amount of time. It's just that now coming back and saying that that time is a due process violation, when he did have some control over the time it took for him to file the post-conviction petition to get the claim to begin to be litigated, so to speak. So then the next time that we need to look at is the time from the post-conviction petition that was docketed and a counsel was appointed. And then we have an 8-year period where his post-conviction appointed attorney requested and was given continuances on his behalf. And counsel in his reply brief seems to infer that they were just for the transcripts, but that's not the case at all. In that time, counsel was investigating the defendant's claims, speaking to the defendant, trying to formulate his claims into a cognizable form under her 651C duties. And if you look at that post-conviction petition, it wasn't just the ineffective assistance for failure to file a notice of appeal. He had a number of other claims in there. Failure to call eyewitnesses, including Derek Webster, who's at issue with this appeal, Crystal Carter, and his uncle, Kevin Duncan, all of whom he said were eyewitnesses at the trial. He had another claim for failure to investigate possible defenses and a claim about a void conviction. Any of which, if those had been meritorious, could have resulted in a new trial, irrespective of his direct appeal. So it was to his benefit for his attorney to investigate those claims fully and put those forth in the best possible light to advocate for the defendant. And so those 8 years are at his behest, and we have nothing in the record that shows the defendant was unhappy with his representation, that he never tried to move that proceeding along in any way. And, in fact, he filed something to Judge Porter. He actually sent a letter to him asking for an additional claim, which he titled a supplemental post-conviction petition, which the judge had the parties indoctrinate, kind of include in the initial petition. The state responded to it on a Fourth Amendment claim. So the defendant, and that's important for two reasons. One, the defendant clearly knew how to advocate for himself. He had a way of getting in touch with the judge and filing other documents. And on top of that, it kind of explains why it took such a long time, because there were so many issues involved, and the defendant was adding issues.
I don't think anything explains why it took such a long time.
Well, looking at the time, the reason for the delay, that is one of the factors that played into that. So that brings us to our fourth factor, which even in this long delay, we have to look at whether or not it was prejudicial to the defendant. And under that standard, and the Sims Court held, we have to see if there's any basis to conclude that the outcome would be different had his appeal been perfected earlier. And in this case, there is not. Because he's bringing all of his claims forward today, and none of his claims are meritorious. And they would not have been meritorious then, and they're not meritorious now. And this court can fully review all of the claims that are being brought in his direct appeal, because we do have a full transcript. We have a full transcript of the trial and the sentencing hearing and the pretrial proceedings, which are the basis of his claim. And to the extent that counsel is pointing out that we do not have the findings from Judge Porter, his actual findings at his bench trial, as Justice Quish pointed out, there's no requirement he actually make findings. The court can give reasons or no reasons at all, and we have no reason to know that he did give any specific findings. We have his trial order in the file, so we know what counts were found that the defendant was found guilty on. We know that he was found guilty of intentional murder, strong probability, and felony murder based on the aggravated battery of a firearm. And that shows us that he found the people's witness to be credible, and he found the defendant's claim of self-defense to be incredible. So because of that, the transcript is just, it's not material to a meaningful review of defendant's claims. And once we look at his claims on appeal right now, they're not meritorious, and the defendant hasn't been prejudiced by that delay. And to point out again that there have been no cases that have given the remedy the defendant is seeking, which is purely a new trial based on the delay. And to this point, he's been serving, as the court found in Sims, he's been properly serving his 66-year sentence for this murder and these three attempt murder convictions. And just turning to the sufficiency of the evidence that the defendant is saying, this court can review based on the record before it, because as we know under Jackson versus Virginia, the full record is there, and the standard is whether any rational trier of fact could find as the trial court did. So to that extent, this court can point to factors to affirm the trial court that the trial court didn't even refer to itself. So once again, pointing that the findings from the trial judge really are not material to this court's review of the defendant's claims in this case. And we would submit that the judge made a proper finding that the defendant was proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of murder and these three counts of attempt murder, because the evidence was more than sufficient. It was overwhelming that he turned and he fired upon these groups of unarmed men and a boy. The three surviving witnesses and the defendant's friend all consistently testified that nobody had a gun, nobody had done anything provoking or done anything at all, that the defendant just passed by them, turned around, and then shot five times into this group from a very close distance away.
Wasn't there one witness that said that they heard something that sounded like a gunshot other than the defendant?
Well, the defendant said that, right, for the popping sound. The one witness who said that said that he heard what he thought were firecrackers, but it was actually the defendant shooting. He said that he heard firecrackers, and his friend said, they're shooting. And it was those sounds, we believe the inference from that testimony was that those actually were the defendant shooting at him, and that's why he didn't turn around initially. So outside of these popping noises, which is the only person who said that there was any popping noises prior to the defendant open firing, was the defendant himself. And to that extent, the court properly rejected his self-defense argument because he didn't prove any of the elements of self-defense. I mean, once the defendant puts forth some evidence of the six elements of self-defense, it's the people's burden to disprove them. But in this case, the defendant proved none of them, and the people disproved five of them. No one, including the defendant, testified that anybody had a gun. But the defendant said he turned and he wasn't looking at hands. He never saw anyone shooting at him, and he never saw anyone with a gun. He was clearly the aggressor. He admitted that he brought a gun to the scene that day in case something happened. And his belief in the use of force was completely objectively unreasonable, and subjectively, it was not credible in this case. And just to touch on the shell casings that counsel has brought up, based on the stipulation. Because this is a totality of the evidence situation, we're able to look, as the standard is, in the light most favorable to the people. The stipulation is both internally inconsistent and externally, would suggest, based on all the evidence in case, that there were no bullets or shell casings found on the scene.
But we can't just write the word no into that stipulation when we have absolutely no evidence to do so, right? And to counsel's point about if you had wanted to change the record or amend the record, supplement the record, there's a procedure under Rule 329 that no one used in this case.
That's correct, that we have to take, we're taking it as is. But if you look at the stipulation, it's a stipulation to what the evidence technician would testify. And evidence technicians just don't testify like that. They would not say no bullets or, that they found bullets or shell casings. There was no caliber, there was no number, no testimony about inventories or recoveries, no testimony about where they are located. So based on that totality, the only logical inference is that there was an inadvertent scrivener's error or somebody, a slip of the tongue, and the word no didn't come out. So when...
But there was bullet damage to a nearby building.
There was bullet damage to a building, yes. But there was absolutely no, which our position is that goes to show that maybe if there was a bullet that went through that, the defendant said it's consistent with the people's case. The defendant said he shot 5 times, right? And 2 of the surviving victims were each struck once. The deceased victim had 2 through-and-through wounds, which is 4 bullets, and bullets, and the 5th bullet likely went through that door. So that would be consistent with the people's theory of the case, that there was bullet damage to that door. But there's just, this court has the photographs that are part of the record on the appeal, and you can see that there's no shell casings or bullets in those pictures. And there's no evidence markers that the evidence technician would have put in had he found shell casings. And there's no pictures of the individual shell casings or bullets, as are usually a part of the duties of an evidence technician. Furthermore, this court can look to the fact that there was no firearms examiner testimony. There was no testimony that anything was sent to be tested at a crime lab. There was no mention in the closing argument of either bullets or shell casings for either side. So if we look at the totality of all of the evidence in this case, the only logical conclusion is that there wasn't bullets or shell casings. And even if we take it as counsel wants, as it says in the stipulation, to that extent, it has no evidentiary value, because what was recovered then? Was it bullets or was it shell casings? He wants it to be shell casings because he says that supports his argument that there was another shooter, but that's not even what the stipulation says. It says bullets or shell casings. Maybe that was bullets then. Who knows? Because it doesn't make any sense, really. And so to argue that, and to Justice Bush's point, it just doesn't connect back to this case. The defendant testified that there were shootings 4 days a week in that neighborhood, that there was constant gunfire, which put him in the state of mind that he was in. So there's no saying that if there were bullets or shell casings, that it had any connection to this case at all.
Then why would the party stipulate to admit it into evidence if it was completely irrelevant from a different shooting or a different situation?
Well, our position is that the evidence was a negative evidence. They were admitting that the evidence technician came and took these pictures, so they could enter the pictures into evidence and found no bullets or shell casings, but that for some reason either it was misheard or mistyped. That's not how it looks to be in this record. We do not feel in any way that the stipulation was supposed to read bullets or shell casings, because that doesn't make any sense in this case, or in any case really. And so the only logical inference is that it should have said no bullets or shell casings. So if there are no further questions, if I can touch on the comment about the ARDC violations.
Please.
Okay. The defendant cannot establish that he received ineffective assistance of counsel for his attorney's unrelated professional or personal issues that they had during this trial. And really, he's talking mostly about Mr. Tolles. And while he's saying that he's not asking for a per se rule, he did so ask for in his brief, and at the end of his oral argument, he did again ask for a per se rule. And that's not what this court or the Illinois Supreme Court has stated as a standard for such a claim. And in fact, these courts have continually said that we need to look at whether the performance fell below, that they must establish that the circumstances affected counsel such that the performance fell below reasonable professional standards, and that absent those distractions, the outcome would be different. And the defendant just can't make that showing here. The items that he refers to in his brief and in his reply brief are mostly taken out of context, or some of them are actually just completely incorrect. He makes a statement in his reply brief that nobody showed up for counsel on a particular day. And when looking at that page in the record, the case is passed, and the court actually tells the defendants, your attorneys were here, this case has been continued. But regardless, isolated attorneys not showing up at pretrial proceedings 18 months before trial just doesn't show ineffective assistance of counsel. There was nothing happening during those proceedings that could impact their representation such to the level that the outcome would be different. And if we look at what happened during the trial performance itself, he makes a point that I should, that we should likewise correct about Mr. Tolles having to leave early. That actually, in the record, it was not a reference to Mr. Tolles. They did have a sidebar on a very, very thorough cross that Mr. Tolles did of Antonio Edwards on his prior inconsistent statement and the statements why he was testifying the way he was. And he did get, the only favorable ruling he got out of that was that he was willing to, he could ask foundational questions about the reason Antonio Edwards said he was going to change his testimony. Antonio Edwards testified that he had originally said that Tavares had a gun, and that was because he was dating the defendant's girlfriend and had a close relationship with his mother, and that he changed his story, he changed his account to the truth a year later and was consistent. And anyway, so at that point he had talked to his grandmother. Mr. Tolles did a thorough cross-examination of that whole line of testimony, and at the end all he could ask was foundational questions. So it wasn't really material to the impeachment. At that point, counsel, Mr. Jordan said, it's 4:15, at 4:30, I know that counsel has to leave. Mr. Tolles and I looked at our schedule, and these are the days that we are free. There's four counsels there. He didn't refer to Mr. Tolles having to leave early, and he obviously was talking about Mr. Tolles by name in that same statement, so the inference is probably the prosecutors who had to leave early, but either way, him having to leave early doesn't even impact the trial, because if you look at their performances, they did an excellent job. Mr. Jordan did the primary focus, which was opening, closing, and the cross of three state's witnesses, and Mr. Tolles was very effective. He did a very thorough cross-examination of Antonio Edwards. He did an excellent direct of the defendant. He rehabilitated him throughout when he got some of his times wrong, and they really didn't have much to work with, because the witnesses themselves were internally consistent and inconsistent with each other, and the defendant's self-defense claim was unbelievable and insufficient. So they really did the best that they could with what they had in this case and provided him excellent representation.
What about the fact that they didn't additionally cross-examine that witness after the court said they could get into certain areas but not every area?
Well, that area, the material that the court said that they could cross-examine him on was just foundational questions as to when he talked to the grandmother that they were going to be unable to prove up anyways because nobody knew the grandmother's address or had any way of bringing her to court. So while they could have asked him the who, what, when, where, and how of this conversation with his grandmother that motivated him to come to court, the evidence wasn't going to have much import when there's no way to prove up if he said it either way. They did go on to do a redirect and a thorough recross about the same circumstances surrounding his testimony. There was just nowhere else to take that line of questioning at that time. And so to touch briefly on counsel's...
Counsel compares this case to the People v. Williams,
yes,
which is a case where the Supreme Court found some very unique facts that necessitated a reversal of the case.
Yes.
Strickland, I know, hadn't come out yet, but decided not to even follow the current standard that they had at the time, which now would be a Strickland analysis.
Yes.
Counsel compared our facts to those facts.
Okay.
Do you want to respond to that?
Absolutely, yes. And no case, the first point I have to say is no case has followed Williams since Williams was decided. No court. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that Williams has been called an aberration, it's been called an anomaly. Those specific facts have yet to ever been followed, and they couldn't be more different from our facts, quite frankly. In Williams, the attorney was a sole attorney representing three defendants in a four-defendant case, a death penalty case, simultaneously in two juries. So in two different jury trials with these three defendants, and cases that have continually distinguished them, and we've heard all of them in our brief, point out the fact in a situation where you have, in this case, two co-counsels, so these are two solo practitioners that came together to represent this defendant jointly, two attorneys representing a single defendant in a bench trial that's not a capital case, it's just a completely different situation. And the evidence was much more specific in Williams, and which the court pointed to as one of the reasons that it might have been difficult for this attorney to do on his own, representing three defendants. And in this case, the evidence is quite straightforward. I mean, it was mostly testimonial, and there was four witnesses in this trial. It was conducted over two days in a bench trial setting. So the facts couldn't be more different from Williams, on top of the fact that every court who's ever looked at Williams has not followed it, because they say that, I think Williams itself said that these facts are unlikely to ever be duplicated.
Sanchez gets close, though. Does that, that's another case that counsel cites, too?
Yes, it did. But in Sanchez, I believe, and I have to look at my summary, but I believe that the attorney in Sanchez had just been arrested and was going to be prosecuted by the same prosecutor's office as his client. And so they found that in Sanchez, him having, you know, his own criminal case kind of, and I believe it was a felony, but I can't recall the exact facts of that. So, but it was definitely more serious than traffic matters, which is what Mr. Tolles had. And based on the record we have before us, we really don't even know that there's an overlap of his traffic cases. There was reference that he pled guilty in 1998, almost 3 years before he got involved in this case. And the ARDC got involved in it way, like, after, in 2004, after the defendant was already sentenced. But there's really nothing besides these documents that the defendant appends to his brief that were not part of the record that refers to any of the proceedings actually overlapping with the defendant's case. And even if they did overlap, he can't prove that that Mr. Tolles performed in any kind of substandard setting in this case based on the record we have before us and the job he did with the portions of the trial that were assigned to him. And so just to touch last briefly on the sentencing issue that counsel brought up at the end, just on this one, defendant is arguing that the court referred to the juvenile adjudication, which has been void ad officio, pursuant to Aguilar. But it's important to note, and we did so in our brief, the judge only referred to that in mitigation. He didn't refer to it at all in aggravating evidence. All he said is that in aggravation, and this court was meticulous in his sentencing order. He listed every single factor that he was looking to, and he said that in aggravation, the defendant has a criminal background. That's all he said. And he did, completely apart from this juvenile adjudication. He had a felony conviction for possession of a controlled substance, and he had another juvenile adjudication for a narcotics case as well, which could be considered under the sentencing guidelines. Then he went on to mention other factors, which was necessary to protect the public, cause and threaten serious harm, when he got into necessary to deter others. When he got to mitigation, he said, in mitigation, the defendant has a prior work record, and that's the only factor I find in mitigation. And then he said, oh, and in mitigation, also the defendant had no prior crimes of violence in his background. I did not consider the possession of firearms as a juvenile to be a crime of violence. So if anything, he mentioned it as an oversight.
But he said, I didn't consider it to be a crime of violence. He doesn't say I didn't consider it at all. He's just saying, I didn't consider that conviction to be a crime of violence. So doesn't that lend support for defendant's argument that the court did consider that conviction despite the fact that it was void?
And the interpretation from the record almost made it seem like in case someone said that it would be a crime of violence, he was just saying that this wasn't a crime of violence because it had no import to him. But even if you could say he considered it as part of his background just because he specifically listed it, it was minimal, and remand's not necessary for this sentencing case based on the record before it. The court went through a very extensive sentencing or a sentencing finding, saying all of the factors that it looked at in sentencing the defendant as it did, and all of those are within the proper range. And this minor this minor mention, if to be interpreted that way, would not be of such import to change the result of the sentencing hearing. And it should be pointed out that because the defendant didn't file a motion to reduce sentence, this is actually evaluated under a plain error standard. So it just wouldn't rise to second prong plain error.
He would have had an attorney retained that would have filed that, correct?
Well, they were still retained on the day of sentencing, so they certainly could have filed it on that day. And there's no claim that they erred in not filing a motion to reduce sentence. So, and since the evidence at sentencing wasn't closely balanced, I guess is what I'm trying to say, that the harm, it doesn't rise to a plain error violation if by mentioning it in mitigation, it actually counts as mentioning it. I don't know how I am on time, but
a little.
Okay. Are there any further questions? If there are no further questions? If I may briefly conclude, for these reasons and the reasons in our brief, the people of the state of Illinois respectfully request that this honorable court affirm defendant's convictions and sentences.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I will try to be brief. I will put you busy with enough reading and speaking here today. Just a couple things. I'm going to bounce around a little bit, if you'll excuse me. The first thing I want to say is counsel made some arguments about the delay once we hit post-conviction proceedings and it not being based on transcripts. I'm just going to read a couple dates. January 24, 2007, this was the first time counsel stood up, appeared on Duncan's post-conviction petition. I would note that the circuit court said defendant has an attorney. This was another time denying Duncan's motion for trial transcripts. Defendant has an attorney can order transcripts if she thinks that's appropriate. I might send him a letter telling him.
Counsel, you need Remember that we're audio recording this, so you probably need to go half a mile an hour.
Slower, I'm sorry, okay. I might send him a letter telling him, that's about the third one he sent me. Next one is going to take some money out of his pocket. April of 2007, counsel says, I have ordered the transcripts from the reporter's office because there was no appeal. Again, this is relating back to counsel's error in the very beginning. January 2008, a year later, I have received one of the three ordered transcripts which had to be transcribed, missing another. April 2008, there are some outstanding transcripts. July 2008, this case is missing transcripts. July 2011, the court notes that the pro se motion for trial transcripts was denied. Again, Darius is still trying to get them. This looks to be about his fifth or sixth one. September of 2011, there were six separate court reporters. I received four transcripts. I'm still waiting on the other two. April 2012, I am in receipt of a portion of Duncan's transcripts. So this carried throughout the entire time that Darius Duncan was adopted for second stage proceedings. Counsel could not get the transcript. And we know she couldn't get the transcripts that were missing because she never received them. Instead, we have that affidavit. Regarding counsel saying that there was not miscommunication, excuse me, between counsels, I'm again just going to read a little bit from the record here. In December of 2000, Jordan informs the court that Tolles will be working with him, but I haven't talked to him. I thought he would be here. I brought my files to share with him. He's not here. I will certainly make an effort to call counsel. April of 2001, I am one of the attorneys on this case. We are not from the same office. We have not spoken. I don't know what time he's going to be here. May of 2001, I apologize. This was after counsel was late. I apologize. There was confusion. I thought counsel was going to be here. June of 2001, this was actually right after Howard Tolles had been arrested for the second or third time while he was representing Darius. Mr. Duncan, is one of your lawyers going to show up? Darius, he was supposed to be here. They didn't tell you they weren't going to show up? No. December of 2001, Mr. Duncan, who is your lawyer? Howard Tolles, have you heard from him? No, I haven't. He's supposed to be here. Can you get in here on the 31st? I can try. On December 31st, Tolles was late. Says an answer was filed earlier when Jordan was there, which didn't actually occur. June of 2002, they wanted to proceed to a 402 conference. Darius Duncan expressed that he hadn't been able to get in touch with his attorneys to discuss his 402 conference. Jordan says, I have no idea where Mr. Tolles is. I was calling. He said he was going to be here. I called and had his cell phone number. There was no word. There was no answer. July of 2002, Tolles was not able to show up. In subsequent dates, in August of 2002, Jordan thinks there's a demand for trial when there isn't. And in October of 2002, Tolles thinks there's a demand for trial when there isn't. And I've already got into the date when it was set for trial and Howard Tolles missed subsequent dates and still didn't show up to court. Regarding prejudice from the delay, in addition to the loss of these transcripts, there's other prejudice to consider. One would be prejudice on retrial. At this point, we're decades beyond the trial. Any potential witnesses that Darius could have, for example, one of the witnesses or one of the claims before this court was that counsel's never even interviewed one of the two witnesses who were with Darius who would have corroborated or could have corroborated Antonio Edwards' testimony regarding the sight of a gun, Derek Webster. They never interviewed him. Howard Tolles responded to the ARDC, said, I was never made aware of him, even though he was listed as a witness.
No, he said, I was never made aware of him as a favorable witness. He didn't say, I was never made aware of him.
Well, he was made aware of him as a witness.
Right, but as a favorable witness is what he says in that ARDC letter. But again, that's not part of the direct appeal transcript or the record on direct appeal. That's from documents that were attached to a post-conviction petition, which were not at issue in this appeal, right?
Well, again, this is all one case, and that is on the record before this court. And I just want to briefly touch on there were multiple instances of counsel talking about no prejudice. Like, for example, with the void conviction, counsel one says it doesn't even matter because attorneys didn't file a motion to reconsider, which again just sort of highlights the catch-22 that Darius is in. Or the fact that the trial court only found one factor in mitigation. Again, that's because trial counsel didn't put forth any mitigation in a case when Darius had multiple family members showing up to every court date. Again, counsel says evidence will not closely balance at sentencing. Maybe it would have been if they presented any evidence in mitigation. And the prejudice regards to delay is not only, you know, this appeal, a potential retrial, but also if there was any sentencing relief. He's already, as I said, he's been in custody for 27 years. So any sentencing relief may prove moot by the, at the point, at this point, because he's served so much time before getting a proper appeal. And relatedly, in regards to the loss of these transcripts, we actually don't know the trial court's credibility determinations, and it's different. Counsel repeatedly said Darius hasn't been prejudiced. That's different. Saying he hasn't been prejudiced is much different than saying he cannot establish prejudice, and that's where we're at in this case. We don't. The court could have made findings. You're of course right that we don't know whether it did or not, but actually foreclosing any way to affirmatively prove prejudice is entirely different than saying he hasn't been prejudiced. And to me, that's the key difference that the state refuses to consider. And there, in the briefing, I won't get into all the details now because I know I'm running out of time. There is a decent amount of federal cases presented with similar situations where there's lengthy delays that result in or caused by the state being unable to provide, to furnish transcripts. And there's various equitable remedies that this court could impose. In Pope versus Taylor, which is a Seventh Circuit case from 2024, which I believe is a 25-year delay in Wisconsin, the court crafted an equitable remedy where they remanded with instructions that the defendant be conditionally released pending commencement of trial. And if that trial wasn't commenced within, I believe in that case it was 3 months, it was an unconditional vacation of the sentences. That is another equitable remedy that could be before this court. Or such as another equitable remedy would be reducing Darius' sentence to the length of this delay. Remanding the case, but with instructions at least that it be commenced within a certain amount of time. As I said, this has been going on for far too long. The fact that Darius' attorneys, it took so long for them to be indefinitely suspended, also went on for far too long. Because of various contributing factors, none of which have to do with Darius, he's no longer able to obtain a full and fair review of his conviction, because that is no longer possible. We ask that you reverse his convictions and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As I stated in the beginning, before we actually began, as a precursor to the beginning, I stated that we're missing one justice, and he is not here, but he will be participating. For those who came in late, so they can know the full scope of what we've done, he will be participating by audio. This is being recorded. And he will be listening to the audio version of what happened here today. He's already read the transcripts. And then he will join us in our deliberations regarding what we are bound to do according to the statute. Thank you.
All right.